Today we're going to be talking with the author of a brand new book called The Lolita Effect, How Media Sexualization of Young Girls Takes Place and What We Can Do About It. It should be a wonderful show on a great and pressing issue of our times. So join us today for Media Matters. But first, before we go to our guests, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Dr. Susan Lin is a child psychotherapist who directs the Campaign for Commercial-Free Childhood. Her work focuses on the need to protect children from the relentless onslaught of marketing and advertising.
Democracy thrives when there's a population of citizens who can think creatively, who can engage in critical thinking, who aren't totally blindsided and susceptible to hype.
Lynn's latest book, The Case for Make-Believe, Saving Play in a Commercialized World, draws on her 30 years of experience working with children. Lynn says that commercialized culture actually prevents children from playing and using their imaginations.
We've reached a point in society where nurturing creative play has actually become countercultural. And in large part, that's because it's a threat to corporate profits. Children who play creatively don't need as many of the things that corporations sell.
Children are bombarded with advertising for toys that are often linked to movies and TV shows. And toys now are often embedded with computer chips so that simply pressing a button makes the toy jump or dance or talk or sing.
But the toys are actually having more fun and engaged in more self-expression than the children are.
Lynn says that to raise healthy, creative, curious, thinking children, we need to give them the experience of conjuring something out of nothing. We need to provide them opportunities to truly interact with the world.
It's really important to remember that make-believe, that creative play, is absolutely essential to the health and well-being of children. It's the foundation of learning. It's key to school success. It's central to creativity and to the ability to make meaning of life.
She says parents need to take responsibility for making thoughtful choices about introducing children to the market-driven media at such young ages. But parents need help from educators, healthcare professionals, and mental health professionals as well. Lynn feels the public health community needs to take a stronger stance against advertising to children and start lobbying for better policies to keep marketers away from children's TV programs and develop parent education programs.
There is an obstacle to these organizations becoming more involved, and that is that many of them take funding from corporations or a partnership with corporations who have a vested interest in making sure that we don't have government policies.
For more information, go to commercialfreechildhood.org.
Earlier this year at the TED Conference, an annual invitation-only gathering of luminaries from the fields of technology, entertainment, and design, Alyssa Miller of Public Radio International gave a presentation about why the U.S. media is showing less of the world than ever before. She started off with statistics for the news coverage for February of 2007.
This was a month when North Korea agreed to dismantle its nuclear facilities. There was massive flooding in Indonesia. And in Paris, the IPCC released its study confirming man's impact on global warming. The U.S. accounted for 79% of total news coverage. And when we take out the U.S. and look at the remaining 21%, we see a lot of Iraq and little else. The combined coverage of Russia, China, and India, for example, reached just 1%. So why don't we hear more about the world? One reason is that news networks have reduced the number of their foreign bureaus by half. Aside from one-person ABC mini-bureaus in Nairobi, New Delhi, and Mumbai, there are no network news bureaus in all of Africa, India, or South America, places that are home to more than 2 billion people. The reality is that covering Britney is cheaper. And this lack of global coverage is all the more disturbing when we see where people go for news. Last year, Pew and the Columbia J School analyzed the 14,000 stories that appeared on Google News' front page, and they, in fact, covered the same 24 news events. Similarly, a study in e-content showed that much of global news from U.S. news creators is recycled stories from the AP Wire services and Reuters, and don't put things into a context that people can understand their connection to it. In recent years, Americans who say they closely follow global news most of the time grew to over 50%. The real question is this distorted worldview. What we want for Americans in our increasingly interconnected world.
To see the video of Alyssa Miller's presentation, go to TED.com.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Coming to you live today, August 24th, 2008, from WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is Gigi Durham, a professor of journalism and mass communication at the University of Iowa. Durham is the author of the brand new book, The Lolita Effect, The Media Sexualization of Young Girls and What We Can Do About It. Welcome to Media Matters, Gigi Durham.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. This is a book that's a I'd say it's a pleasure to read, but I think would be not exactly right given the nature of the topic. But it's a well-written book that was easy for me to read and provocative on every page. For the sake of our listeners, let's just start right at the beginning, if we can, Professor Durham. What is the Lolita Effect? Why the title, and what does that mean?
Well, I mean, the Lolita Effect is a reference, of course, to the Nabokov novel in which the 12-year-old protagonist, Lolita, is molested by her stepfather. And the way the term Lolita has come to be understood in American popular culture, and I think popular culture in general, is in terms of a young girl who's inappropriately sexual and who's very seductive and who seduces older men into sexual activity that isn't appropriate, given the age of the child. And but in this construction, you know, the blame is always squarely placed on the girl, you know, as being sort of knowledgeable beyond her years and, you know, acting out in inappropriate ways. And when you actually look back at the book, Lolita, of course, is not to blame for this. I think like any, you know, adolescent girl, she's curious about sex. She's experimented a little bit. But in any relationship of that type, it's never, you know, it's never the child that's at fault. It's the molester. It's the abuser. And it's clearly Humbert who, you know, sort of put her in this sort of untenable position and almost held her captive as a sort of sexual slave. From that, when I look at the ways in which girls are being represented in contemporary media, there's a lot of sort of horrified, public discourse about, you know, how these girls are presenting themselves and how girls are dressing. And there's an awful lot of sort of criticism of the girls themselves. But the Lolita Effect, to me, is the fact that they are being presented in these ways by media industries who profit from that sort of representation, and that the girls themselves, like Lolita, are sort of hapless and innocent, almost victims of a corporate Humbert Humberts, if you will.
Well, Gigi Durham, we're going to go in detail through your argument. You talk about the great myths that are created that sort of prop up, that are part of the Lolita Effect, mm-hmm. In the book, and I want to go through those. But before we get into the detail of the book, a little more on the basics. How much, you know, one of the arguments, and you talk about this a bit in the book, that comes up is that the market for much of the media that's aimed at young girls is young girls themselves. I mean, that they're the ones who are consuming this media. Mm-hmm. And the commercial media companies, the Disneys and Time Warners and Nickelodeons and the manufacturers that advertise on them are simply giving these girls what they want.
Well, yes. I mean, that's a really complicated question because I'm not sure that girls left to their own devices would want the types of, especially the kinds of constructions of sexuality that are being peddled to them by these corporations. You know, I think left to their own devices, and I have two young daughters, and I spend a lot of time with, you know, little girls, and they're, you know, they're sort of wonderfully creative, and, you know, yes, they're interested in sort of imitating adults by sort of playing around with makeup and high heels and things like that, but they're also, you know, they'll also wear firefighter's outfits, and they'll also, you know, sort of be rough and tumble in the backyard, and, you know, little girls, like all of us, are, you know, complex and creative and multidimensional beings. So so I don't think we can make the argument that the corporations are selling them what they want, because I think what they want would be very, very different from this very narrowly defined, mythical and profit-motivated version of sexuality that's kind of being imposed on them in order to generate huge profits for these corporations. So no, they're not getting what they want. They're being coached to want it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what are some of the, I mean, we're going to go through some of the details, because you go in great detail in the book through some of the real problems, the social effects, the consequences for human lives of the Lolita effect. Give our listeners a sense of what some of the major ones are.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I start with, of course, are just that in the U.S. we have extremely high rates of teen pregnancy and of teen STDs. We have the highest rates of teen pregnancy in the industrialized world, twice that of the U.K. and France, about 4 times that of Germany and 8 times that of Japan. So, and then a recent CDC study that was out earlier this year, I think in March, showed that one in four 14 to 19-year-old U.S. girls has an STD, a sexually transmitted disease. And, it's, you know, for example, in countries like Finland, the teen pregnancy and STD rates are extremely low. So it's quite clear that we're not doing a good job of giving girls the sort of healthy understanding of sexuality and their bodies that they need in order to live good lives. So my book is not anti-sex. It's definitely about looking for ways to provide girls and everyone, really, but girls in particular, with a better understanding of sexuality that would actually be good for them in the long run and that would enable them to make good decisions about their sex lives. So I think, in part, we can see the negative consequences. Other problems that I identify from the research as I go through the book are the very high rates of child sexual abuse, the teen dating violence, because there's such a linking of sex with violence in many media representations of sex.
Mm-hmm.
And also child sex trafficking and prostitution, which are multi-billion-dollar industries. And, you know, and what we need to do when we look at the media is look at whether they're actually, you know, working to combat this sort of exploitation of children, sexual exploitation of children, or are they actually contributing to it? So.
And Gigi Durham, do you think that these problems are growing worse, or are these long-term problems that have existed for decades and decades, or are you seeing an appreciable increase in some of these problems?
Yeah, actually, some of them, the rates are going up. Like teen pregnancy, we have had a slight rise in the numbers in the last couple of years. The STD rates are definitely higher. The sexual abuse rates, it's very hard to figure out for sure. The U.S. Department of Justice actually shows a slight decline in sexual abuse, but I think, I mean, so much of it is unreported, and predators have gotten very clever about hiding their tracks, so I think it's difficult to actually know what's going on, and the rates still remain very high. I think it's an estimated 25%, one in four girls have been sexually abused, and 20% of boys, one in five, so those numbers are still really quite high. In terms of the media, a number of studies have shown that the amount of sexual content in media and the explicitness of the portrayals have increased over the past 20 years, so we do have some good data on that.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Professor Gigi Durham from the University of Iowa. She's joining us to discuss her brand new book, The Lolita Effect, The Media Sexualization of Young Girls and What We Can Do About It. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. The phone number here at Media Matters, if you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Professor Durham, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And as of now, our phone lines are open. Gigi, you were talking about the crucial role of media as a central factor in the Lolita effect, and it's a central theme of the book. And you tell the story, you know, it's difficult, as you point out, to always disentangle media from all the other aspects of our lives that are so closely intertwined. But one of the examples you give in the book that I thought was quite striking was in the island of Fiji and what happened when television was introduced there. Can you just explain that to our listeners?
Yes, that's actually a really fascinating field experiment, if you will. Let me get the date right here, just by checking.
I think it's 1999.
1999. A group of Harvard anthropologists were on the island of Fiji, which is in the Pacific Ocean, and what they had found is while they were there, that especially studying local teenagers, that the incidence of eating disorders was almost nothing. They were practically unknown on the island, and then in 1999, Western television was introduced, and the director of research at the Harvard Eating Disorders Center reported that the sudden infusion of Western cultural images and values through TV changed the way Fijian girls viewed themselves and their bodies, and the eating disorder rates, just went sky high. Suddenly, anorexia and bulimia were prevalent on the island among teen girls, and when the anthropologists interviewed them, they said they did it because they wanted to look like the characters on, at the time, TV shows like Beverly Hills 90210 and Baywatch.
That instantly points out two things to me, and there's both themes in your book. They're important themes, in fact. One is the global nature of the problem. This isn't a problem that ends at the U.S. borders.
Mm-hmm.
And is that a growth area? How big is globalization in this process of the Lolita effect?
Globalization is an absolutely key part of the whole effect because, of course, we live in an era of transnational media. I mean, these images are not just... They don't, as you're pointing out, they don't just circulate in the U.S. They're transmitted worldwide, and they're having really significant impacts. I think the Fiji study is a really dramatic example of this. But, for example, there was a study in Thailand, a study of teenagers in Chiang Mai, that showed that girls are experiencing stress and depression as a result of Western media's portrayal of sex and gender roles because, culturally they're sort of struggling with the traditional concepts of behavior and body and so forth and these newly imposed images, and it's causing all sorts of generational conflicts and internal conflicts and just the ways in which women are being viewed are shifting and changing because of all this, sometimes with violent results, sometimes, with the kinds of problematic results like eating disorders. And to me, some of it is really sad because in some countries, the types of bodies that were, that were sort of appreciated or the range of bodies that were considered to be beautiful was, quite diverse and quite different from the types of bodies that are held up as sexually desirable in our Western media. And so, for example, Barbie bodies were just not the standard in places like Brazil, but they are now.
And we will get to Barbie bodies later because that's one of the most interesting discussions in your new book, The Lolita Effect. The thing that jumps out also to me as I was reading the book, G.G. Durham, is that it's not just media that are play a central role in this, but specifically it's commercial media.
Yes.
I mean, I don't think listening to public access TV or community or public radio stations really plays any role in this whatsoever, as far
as
I can tell. It really, underlying this and not very far below the surface, it's all about commercialism and profit-making.
Yeah, it's totally about that. You're absolutely right. Public television, for example, has all sorts of sort of wonderful positive representations of girls and boys, too, for that matter. But yes, it's the commercial media, and that's, I think, one difference between this book, the book I wrote, and many other books on the same topic about the sexualization of childhood, because I'm really looking at the political economy and how that is the most influential factor in this type of representation. Because as we all know, the media are, it's not, you can't just look at the media and think about it as a single entity. Media industries depend on advertising revenues, and so there's a whole sort of conglomeration of corporations that support the media economically. And so because advertising is the lifeblood of the media, all of the products that are being advertised, have to be moved, and so the media, the corporate media, have to represent sexuality in ways that move the product. So really, all of the representations are profit motivated, and I think what we need to look at, and this is in my book. For example, 17 magazine earned $101.9 million in advertising in 2006. The website Teen People had advertising revenues of almost $77 million. To health and beauty products contributed $1.63 billion to primetime television in 2006. So the media industries, they make their money on advertising, not on subscriptions and not directly from viewers or anything like that. So yeah, it's only about what kind of representations will move the products like fashion and cosmetics and diet aids and plastic surgery and all these things that are advertised in these media. That's a connection that has to be examined.
You know, it seems that from my understanding of advertising history, that the whole notion of a children's market is a relatively recent phenomenon for advertisers to aggressively pursue. And we've seen this vast increase in spending by kids and advertising aimed at kids. And the cardinal rule of advertising, if you can't tell people they're okay the way they are, there's no reason to buy your product. So you have to breed a certain insecurity in people, and then here's the solution, purchase my product.
Yeah, that's absolutely the way it works. And you're right, you know, the children's market has at least advertisers have sort of recognized children and preteens and teens as well as a really lucrative market right now. There's a firm called Euromonitor that I think estimated tweens spending in 2007 at something like, I want to say $700 billion. I mean, it was just some unbelievable amount of money. So, and I think corporations have definitely recognized the value of hooking children onto these products at very early ages in order to create cradle-to-grave consumers of things like you know, certain types of fashion, certain types of cosmetics, and so forth. If kids buy into the ideologies of sexuality and femininity that these corporations are selling, if they buy in early, then they're going to be consumers, you know, for a very long time, and of course the profits will go up. So, you know, again, yeah, it's very much about cultivating cradle-to-grave consumers.
Our guest, Gigi Durham, the author of The Lolita Effect, please call in with questions and comments if you have them at WILL, the phone number 333-9455, toll-free line open 1-800-222-9455. And then, you know, as you've already pointed out, Gigi Durham, this is not the first book addressing the issue of treatment of girls and sexuality in commercial media, in media, the effect it has upon girls, the Lolita effect, as you call it. And it is an issue I think anyone with daughters and sons, for that matter, faces, or a kid or a child themselves faces. Yet, how well do you think this this issue is getting covered in our news media and in our public affairs coverage? How much journalism is going into examining this?
Well, in fact, I mean, because there have been some books out, but I actually haven't seen an awful lot of news coverage about it. You know, every now and then there'll be an author interview. I've done a few interviews myself, even in places where I think this message needs to go out, like People magazine. But I haven't really seen very many sort of in-depth news stories about the whole phenomenon that makes the connections that need to be made between, you know, the ad revenues and the for-profit nature of corporate media and the impact on kids. So I feel as though there ought to be, you know, more.
Yeah, let me ask you this way, Gigi Durham. When you give talks on this to the general public, do you ever have people in the audience stand up and say, this is a really unimportant issue you're raising, this is nonsense, why are you wasting my time? Is that ever a response you get?
No, never.
I wouldn't think so, yeah. So that makes the paradox that much greater.
Yeah.
For why, you know, there's almost a blackout of coverage of this issue in our news media, as far as I can tell.
You're right. It is curious, isn't it? Because usually when I do give talks, it's packed audiences. It's about half men and women. It's not just a women's issue. You know, men seem to be equally interested in this as fathers, as teachers, as counselors, whatever. And everyone seems to agree it's important. So, yeah.
And, you know, that does lead to the issue of, you know, boys' sexuality. And while the book is about girls primarily and the Lolita effect, and I think clearly you present pretty compelling evidence that girls are at the receiving end of the great brunt of the sexual sort of imagery in the media and the effects it has. Boys are certainly a key part of the picture, both as dependent variables and also as independent variables in their own right. Mm-hmm. What's going on with boys?
Yeah, I haven't investigated that, you know, a great deal, but what I do know is that boys are getting the same messages as girls about girls, and so just as girls are being sort of coached to see themselves as sex objects and eye candy and, you know, it's one-dimensional in that sexuality seems to matter, or is supposed to matter more than any other aspect of themselves, boys are getting those same messages about girls, and they're being taught to see girls in those ways, which I think is really getting in the way of sort of ethical relationships, you know, between the sexes or even, you know, in general, in society in general. And then the other aspect of that is also that, you know, representations of boys, and I haven't studied this in any depth, but I think, you know, I think more and more work is being done in this area. The representations that boys are getting are also about achieving a certain type of perfect body, which is, you know, the heavily muscular kind of cut body with the six-pack abs and the extremely powerful physical presence. So boys are being taught that masculinity is about being predatory, about being physically powerful, sometimes about being violent, which is very much a message in a lot of media targeted to boys. And so other aspects of masculinity, intelligence, creativity, compassion, those kinds of things are being devalued in masculine culture, and that's hugely problematic also.
Yeah, one of the ironies from my students when I teach them is that they'll see out of the feminist movement of the 70s, instead of having women held to the standard closer to what men have traditionally been held to, mm-hmm. men are now being increasingly held to the standard women that they're trying to get away from.
I know.
It's sort of the wrong direction for boys.
Right. This is not the kind of equity we wanted.
Well, let's go. The guts of the book, Gigi Durham, The Lolita Effect, the guts of your book really goes through what you call the five myths that buttress or that represent the Lolita Effect, and they're really the heart of the book, the heart of your argument. Let's go through them. And I think each of these, as I read them, having two daughters myself, knowing and consuming mass media myself, struck home with me, and I think will with many of our listeners, if not all of them. So let's just go right through those. The first myth, if you've got it, flaunt it. What do you mean by the myths, and then what is that if you've got it, flaunt it myth?
The first myth is that the more you reveal of your body, the sexier you are, which is a really simplistic formulation. In my examinations of a variety of media that are being aimed specifically to girls, teen magazines and websites and movies and so forth, the word hot is sort of hammered home over and over and over again. You've got to be hot. You've got to be hot.
I think that's Paris Hilton's great contribution to our culture.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And so, like, yeah, so hotness or sexiness is just relentlessly linked to particular images in our popular culture, and mainly that's about sort of bearing as much of the body as possible, and so it's all about kind of female exhibitionism. So the myth about sex there is that sex, which is very, very complex and which is often emotionally based and really can take. It takes shape in sort of a variety of ways. In these media, the only way to be sexual is to reveal your body, and so it puts women very much in the position of having to be on display for the male gaze. And to me, another problem with that, in addition to just the idea that women are always supposed to be on display for men to look at, is that it also negates the idea that a whole range of different kinds of bodies can be, can be beautiful, can be attractive, can be sexual. I mean, everyone is sexual. So it's a very limiting and, in fact, disempowering construction of sexuality.
To make this a little more concrete, give some examples, if you would, from popular media that girls would consume of how this sort of myth is generated and, set out.
Sure. I mean, one very obvious one is sort of, the Bratz dolls, girls with a passion for fashion, and, they're dressed in these really sort of minuscule outfits so that, there's a lot of skin showing.
Let me stop you right there, Gigi, because I think there are probably many listeners who don't have young daughters who missed the entire Bratz doll phenomenon.
Lucky.
That was my next line. You stole it from me. Why don't you explain what that is for those who have not had that privilege?
Yeah, they're these little plastic dolls that have been, very, very successfully marketed to little girls, to preteen girls, toddlers, really. They're supposed to represent a kind of urban chic, I think. But Margaret Talbot, writing in The New Yorker, described them as looking like pole dancers on their way to work at a gentleman's club. And they tend to be dressed in sort of thigh-high platform boots and hot pants and, very minimal clothing, so that, the ideal of femininity that they represent is linked to this sort of hypersexual body display, and that conforms really to a lot of the markers of sex work, which I think is why a lot of people are pretty disturbed by them. And again, I want to sort of emphasize, it's not my position that that women are supposed to cover up from head to foot, or that bodies are somehow shameful. That's not it at all. I mean, I do think everybody ought to celebrate and enjoy their bodies and enjoy their sexuality in developmentally appropriate ways. But I think this the way that it's being presented is that it's about exhibitionism, and it's not about sort of taking pleasure in whatever type of body you might happen to have and recognizing your comfort zones and those kinds of things.
Although in the book you do have a long discussion at points, Gigi Durham, about when girls and boys, for that matter, should begin having sex,
mm-hmm.
Because there's the the argument about what the appropriate age or the right time.
Yeah.
And as I recall, you're not keen on the idea that as soon as puberty is hit, the on switch goes on.
No, absolutely not. Because there's also well-documented medical evidence that puberty is happening earlier and earlier. So, I mean, these days, girls as young as 8 are entering puberty, you know, getting their period. And so, you know, they're far developmentally, cognitively, emotionally, psychologically, at 8, a child is, of course, far too young to engage in sexual activity. So I think puberty is a very terrible marker of sexual readiness, just because the age of puberty is dropping everywhere. This is a global phenomenon.
Are there any countervailing media messages that girls are getting to sort of weigh against this, if you've got it, flaunt it? I mean, or is basically it's either this or just stuff that doesn't deal with the issue at all?
I think that's it, really. I don't see any kind of factual representation of girls who are sort of making choices that make them feel comfortable about who they are and how much they want to display. Actually, that the research on that is really interesting as well, because despite the fact that there's a lot of content analysis in the media that shows that the sexual content, the amount of sexual content and the explicitness of the sexual content in children's media is rising, what they're also finding is that almost none of it discusses sort of healthy sexual practices or, you know, factual sexual information, anything that's going to sort of help them to make good judgments about sexual activity. You know, it's either presented as funny or embarrassing or just sort of, prurient and titillating. But there's no good information, really. I think there are a few media that tend to be not-for-profit that, present a much more complex and positive and empowering version of girlhood, like New Moon magazine, for example, that's published out of Minnesota, or the Canadian show Degrassi, The Next Generation. But there aren't enough of them, and the circulations aren't high enough for kids in general to be getting those kinds of positive messages.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Gigi Durham, a professor of journalism and mass communication at the University of Iowa and author of the brand new book, The Lolita Effect, The Media Sexualization of Young Girls and What We Can Do About It. If you'd like to call in here to WILL AM 580 with a question or comment for Professor Durham, the phone number is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455, and I'm Bob McChesney, your host. The second myth is one you've already alluded to, and I think it's one that will strike home with most of our listeners, even those who don't actively have kids in the home any longer or yet, and that is the anatomy of a sex goddess, and that leads immediately to our good friend Barbie. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, please.
Yeah, it's sort of the second part of the first myth, which is if you've got it, flaunt it, you know. And so there's a qualifier there that you are not allowed to, present your body as attractive or appealing or even think of yourself as sexual or desirable unless you have a particular type of body. And that, of course, is the Barbie body. And it's really interesting whenever I give talks anywhere in middle schools or even in my college classroom and I say, describe what the perfect girl looks like. Somebody is going to end up saying Barbie, so even now Barbie, in spite of everything, in spite of all the years of critique, the debates, in spite of fat pride and the butch mystique and this and that, there's no getting away from this fact that the Barbie body is the one that we still see as the ideal girl's body. And of course,
Gigi Durham, just real quickly to interrupt you, because you make this point in the book, and I've heard this too, but I had never seen it in print before. If you actually take the Barbie body and put it into human-sized dimensions, it's the most absurd body. I mean, it's bizarre.
Yeah, it is bizarre, and it's also completely like unnatural. It couldn't be
an 18-inch waistline.
It would be, yeah, a 5'9" woman with an 18-inch waist, 36-inch breast, 33-inch hips, and she would weigh 110 pounds.
As you point out, she could probably not even stand up physically. I mean,
she'd be too skinny to stand upright. Yeah, she'd be just too thin to even hold herself up. I mean, it's a ridiculous body, and as another analysis pointed out, it would mean that a woman would have sort of a size 10. The top half of her would be a size 10, and the bottom half would be like a size 2, which, again, is just not something that people can realistically achieve, in real life without, really intensive artificial means, borderline starvation, plastic surgery to inflate the breasts. I mean, you just can't have that body without
But I mean, not to be crude or vulgar here, but it isn't a marketer's dream, because you strive for something you can never achieve, so you just keep spending money and killing yourself trying to accomplish it.
Yep, that's the point, isn't it? That that women and girls are being, you know, sort of coached to spend enormous amounts of money to consume and buy the products that are supposed to help them attain this body, and because the body is in fact unattainable, you know, there is no such body in real life. The consumption will go on forever. As we know, plastic surgery industries are, you know, multi-billion dollar industries, the diet industries, laxative industries, you know, fitness industries, all this, they're all geared to, you know, promoting this particular type of body and getting women to continue to consume these kinds of products in the vain pursuit of that body.
We are talking with Gigi Durham, the author of The Lolita Effect, and I want to continue in this vein discussing Barbie and the anatomy of a sex goddess. But first, let's go to the phone lines for a caller who's been waiting very patiently. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. It's nice to hear this topic discussed. Professor Durham, I'm just wondering, this seems to tie into a good deal of our historical background. There's a lot of ambivalence in our society going back to puritanical backgrounds, and it seems to me I remember that Scarlett O'Hara had a 17-inch waist achieved by grabbing hold of a bedpost while someone helped her cinch it tighter and tighter. But it also seems to me that, bearing in mind that we've thought about this for a while, and that our young people are pretty obviously at risk, and we can see that in terms of many sorts of issues that play on their insecurities, the drugs, the alcohol, just some very unrealistic views. And I think that is part of it, that we don't have a very reality-based sense of how human beings appear. But I can't help thinking that there must be enough adults, even those who have served in marketing or the field of advertising or in the media fields, who are actual moms and dads, the results of which products have had a terrible effect on their children, youngsters whose anorexic children have died. It seems to me, if it were possible to create some kind of coalition of these concerned adults, and including in that sensible high school, junior high people, surely, I noticed that it made a big difference for MADD, the Mothers Against Drunk Drivers. There has to be a coalition that could exist if somebody organized it. And I'm just wondering if you would speak to that for a few moments, please. I'm going to hang up and listen to what you discuss. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And Gigi Durham, as you answer that question, because you do this in the book, you might mention some of the existing groups and organizations that are working actively on the causes you talk about in the book.
Yeah, it's a terrific suggestion. And in fact, although there are groups working on this, I don't know of sort of a wide coalition of, you know, parents or, of people from various industries getting together to, you know, to address this issue. And I think we really do need something like that. In part, I wrote the book to try to galvanize that sort of, you know, public discussion so that more and more girls could get involved. But as you're pointing out, there are in fact some out there that are beginning to address it. There's a really great website, the Girls, Women, and Media Project. It's www.mediaandwomen.org, and it's a website developed by the American Psychological Association. It has great resources on the way girls are represented in popular culture, and that website is in fact an outgrowth of the APA's 2007 Task Force report on media and the sexualization of girls, which I draw on in the book, and which really has good, you know, empirical evidence of the negative impacts of a lot of this representation. There's also the Media Awareness Network, which is a Canadian website all about media literacy education and awareness, and with resources, special sections for parents and teachers, and they also have good information about sexism and sexualization in the media. There's, of course, the Media Education Foundation, which Bob's done many videos for them, and they have, you know, incredibly good, especially videos and DVDs about these kinds of issues. Gene Kilborn's Killing Us Softly series is not to be missed there. There's another group called Mind on the Media, and it's a nonprofit group that has a Turn Beauty Inside Out project. So, I mean, they're out there and, here and there, and we just need to sort of keep working on getting more public discussions of these issues going.
Well, let's go back to the Barbie myth while we're speaking of discussions, because this was a very striking chapter. One of the things you mentioned in the book that I've seen before, and I know from my own experience being in my 50s, is how the standard of beauty for women, young women and older women, has changed so dramatically in the past 50 or 60 years. And you talk about this, and I don't know where, now we're at Barbie, but of course 50 years ago, what were considered very attractive, sexually attractive women, prominent celebrities, film actresses, were women today would be considered, conservatively, 30 or 40 pounds overweight.
Yeah, absolutely. That is something I do point out, that, you know, the sex goddesses of the 1940s and 50s were people like Ava Gardner and Marilyn Monroe, and, you know, Marilyn Monroe was a reputed size 14, and if you look at the pictures of her, you know, she has what now she would be considered, to be, you know, sort of overweight. I wonder if she could even get a movie contract now. You know, she has sort of a pudgy belly and, you know, heavy thighs and things like that, and now it's this completely, you know, almost emaciatedly thin body that's the ideal with these inflated breasts. I mean, it's such a different standard, and it has evolved over the years. You know, some people point to Twiggy in the 1960s as beginning the emphasis on extreme thinness and on the sort of adolescent-looking boyish body, which girls have prior to puberty, right, of sort of pre-adolescent thinness. And then as we've moved through the 90s, and the huge breasts have been added to that. And so it's this, again, it's just a bizarre body that has, you know, pre-adolescent proportions with this huge, you know, this voluptuous, this breast, you know, bosom. Yeah.
And before we go to our next caller, just I want to finish up on Barbie if we can. And the point you make, too, which is, I think, oftentimes overlooked, which is, you know, the racist element of Barbie being the beauty ideal for girls.
Yeah, you know, in spite of the fact that Barbie comes with different, you know, skin colors and apparently different racial backgrounds, if you really look at the Barbies, they're all very close to a Caucasian ideal of beauty, with sort of small straight noses, large eyes, and long straight hair. And for the most part, the skin tones are light. So, you know, the very occasional dark-skinned girl, or I mean, dark-skinned Barbie, is quite an anomaly. And when you look at the media and the media representations of beauty, even women of color, the women of color that are celebrated are the ones that approximate a Caucasian ideal. So we have Tyra Banks or Alicia Keys or, you know, Jessica Alba, you know, people who have Barbie bodies and close to Caucasian features. I did an analysis. I've done, you know, I did analyses of many, many media, and really the privileged presentation of beauty is the blue-eyed blonde, which is a standard that's really, you know, impossible for girls of color to attain without, you know, again, considerable sort of artificial effort, you know, hair bleaching and skin bleaching and all, you know, all of this. And so, yes, there's a racial hierarchy that's built into the Barbie ideal as well.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Gigi Durham, who you've just been listening to. She is a professor at the University of Iowa in Journalism and Mass Communication and the author of the brand new book, The Lolita Effect, The Media Sexualization of Young Girls and What We Can Do About It. Let's go back to the phone lines to our callers who've been patiently waiting. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Gigi Durham.
Yes, just a quibble.
Okay.
A caller a while back referred to Puritanism. And what she really should have been saying was Victorianism.
Mm-hmm.
The Puritans had a far healthier attitude towards sex and the human body than the Victorians. The term really goes back to Hawthorne, who was a Victorian to his very fingertips. And I would much prefer to hear us describing these attitudes and behaviors as Victorianisms. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Do you have anything you'd like to say about that, Gigi Durham?
That's really interesting. I'm not a historian. So, I mean, I think of Puritanism in the way I think most people do, as a repressed sort of sexuality. And it would be interesting for me to look more closely into that. Certainly the Victorians perfected that idea that sex is shameful, that, you know, that the body should be hidden. And yet at the same time they had, you know, sort of the secret, expressions of sexuality that made it kind of taboo and dark. And so, yes, I think the Victorians really complicated our understanding of sexuality. And one of the problems that I point to in the book is that in America, I think as a result of all this, we have such a sort of split or schizophrenic attitude towards sexuality, because on the one hand, we think of it as taboo, we won't talk about it, you know, we won't discuss it with our children, we won't give, you know, kids good information about their bodies so they can make, you know, informed choices. But on the other hand, we have this sex-saturated media environment where anything goes. So we're sort of pulled between these two poles of sexual libertarianism, which is, you know, a complete profit-driven version of that, and then this repression and this reluctance to address it or to, you know, talk about it in any sort of accurate, factual, healthy, and open way. So it's those two poles, I think, that are really preventing us from finding a middle ground that's going to actually be progressive.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Our guest today is Gigi Durham, author of The Lolita Effect. Let's go to line two. Champagne, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Bob. Ms. Durham, is your last name D-U-R-H-A-M?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Do you have any DVD or VHS media that you would recommend? I know that there's someone else from Harvard who has tried to follow this for a number of years, and do you have stuff that would be available that could be shown in the middle school and the high school? And I'm calling as an educator. And do you have a website worth repeating several times?
Well, thank you for asking. I mean, I do, in fact, have a website, and it's simple. It's www.lolitaeffect.com. Lolita Effect is all one word, so that's pretty easy to find. Regarding video resources, I actually have a list of resources at the back of the book, but I'll give you a few because I have given talks in middle schools, and there are several things you can use that are helpful. On YouTube, there's the Dove Evolution video, which, you know, in spite of the fact that you know, Dove is a for-profit corporation, they've done some very progressive things in terms of presenting good information about the media manipulations of beauty and sexuality. And so if you look up Dove Evolution, there's a wonderful little 30-second clip of the way an ordinary-looking woman is transformed into this sort of, you know, glamour goddess for a print ad. And it's always, you know, sort of it always makes kids gasp and then really start to think about what they're seeing. As I said, the Media Education Foundation has a number of really, really good DVDs about it, and most libraries have them or can acquire them quite easily. Gene Kilbourne's Killing Us Softly series is on representations of women in advertising. They're just fantastic. Mary Pfeiffer actually did one after she wrote Reviving Ophelia that's also very good. So these are a few examples of DVDs that you could use in the classroom.
Have you considered making a video or DVD yourself?
I'd love to. I think it'd be great.
So if there are any filmmakers out there, get in touch with Professor Durham.
Thanks, Bob.
Well, let's go back to the myths. The next two, the third and fourth myths, are unquestionably, in my mind, the most disturbing in the book. And the third myth is what you call pretty babies. In other words, how increasingly the younger a girl is, the sexier she is. That youth equals sex, so the more youth equals more sexier.
I think that's extremely, extremely troubling. I start off with the example of Madison Gabriel, who was a 12-year-old Australian girl, and she was named as the official face of Australia's Gold Coast Fashion Week in 2007. You know, she was 12, and she was, you know, presented on the runway in these revealing couture outfits and skimpy swimwear, and she was held up as sort of the sexual ideal, a 12-year-old child. And we're seeing this, you know, more and more in various advertisements. A lot of the models that we're seeing in cosmetics ads and fashion ads. I saw a Louis Vuitton ad with a 12-year-old in it. And so these little pre-adolescent girls are being presented to the public as the sexual ideal, which I think is an extremely troubling trend because obviously these are children who are not only under the legal age of consent, but, you know, not capable at that age of making sexual decisions for themselves. And so if we're beginning to see 12- and 13-year-olds as kind of legitimate sexual actors, I think we're in trouble.
And related to this, you talk about in the book child pornography and child prostitution. Mm-hmm. And I gather that both of these are growing considerably at an annual rate.
Yeah, these are, you know, hugely burgeoning industries. The sex trafficking, UNICEF estimates that 1.2 million children are brought into the sex industry every year. All over the world, I could give you, you know, numbers from various countries, but it's absolutely, you know, stunning how many children are in child prostitution and in sex trafficking. And child pornography is also, it is a multi-billion dollar industry. It's growing and growing. So I think this is really the dark side of these representations, and that, you know, the media representations of young children, young girls in particular, as sexual ideals is, you know, tacitly condoning those industries.
And then let's go, I think, to maybe even a more depressing myth, the fourth myth, which is violence is sexy.
Yeah.
And talk a bit about that, and if you would.
Yeah. So the problem, of course, I had a student, I teach gender and sexual anonymity, and the other day I had a student who said something like, sex and violence shouldn't even be in the same sentence, which, it's a position I tend to agree with, just because to me, sex should be, pleasurable, mutual, consensual, and, not violent. Again, the media aimed at teenagers is often connects sex and violence. And I looked in particular at slasher films, and, these have had a long history of critique and debate. And I think it's actually true that the slasher films, the horror films of the 1970s, were actually more progressive than the ones we see now, because in the earlier ones, there wasn't a lot of explicit graphic violence, and also there was what Carol Clover called the final girl. There's usually a strong girl in it who ends up vanquishing the killer, and so there was a sort of feminist message in it. We don't see that anymore. There's no final girl, and the violence has gotten much, much more graphic, and it's usually coupled with sexuality. So, for example, you might see a teenage girl undressing or having sex or, in some really provocative position that's kind of designed to arouse the average straight male viewer, and right at that moment the killer strikes or some horrible violence happens. And so there's this real, linking of sex and violence that, makes arousal and the viewing of violence seem almost natural, and I find that to be highly problematic as well. And then, of course, there's the big can of worms of video games. And, once again, I find it, very troubling that most of the women in these games, many of the women in these games are sex workers, they're strippers or they're prostitutes or something. And again, even if there's not violence directly aimed at them, even though sometimes there is, there's a lot of violence that happens in their vicinity. And so the young boys who tend to be the players of these games are aroused and participating in violence, virtual violence at the same time. And these are very disturbing connections.
It strikes me, Gigi Durham, that in this myth, the violence is sexy. And you talked a lot in the book about the media, the video games, films, music videos that portray this relationship, that this media, unlike, say, for the first or second myth, is really aimed at boys more than girls.
Yeah, it's aimed at boys. Although girls do watch it as well, but boys tend to enjoy them more. They tend to, the audience research shows that boys enjoy slasher films more. They enjoy video games more. Certainly they're getting their cues about masculinity from these media. So boys are really learning that that sex is about violence. That women are and girls are acceptable targets of violence. When the interviews and the qualitative research that's been done with boys also indicates that they are subscribing to these messages.
And then let's now in our closing minutes go to the fifth myth. What boys like, and what do boys like, according to this Lolita effect culture?
Right, and this is, again, it's only about the Lolita, it's how this is being presented in the Lolita effect media culture, because, again, I don't think boys necessarily left to their own devices would particularly need or like these types of constructions of femininity or of women, but in these media, girls are being very much told that they need to appeal to the male gaze, and it's sort of to an imaginary male gaze. So they're being told over and over again that boys want hot girls, and hot girls mean girls that subscribe to these particular definitions of what an ideal body is and what how to dress in order to sort of attract male attention and arousal. It's always very much about pleasing boys. The whole message is about pleasing boys, and there's also very, very little emphasis on girls themselves, what makes them comfortable, what are the ways in which they would like to interact with boys, the ways in which they might want to experience sexual pleasure themselves. I mean, there's absolutely no emphasis on any of that. It's always about, kissing secrets guys wish you knew, which is, from a 17 magazine, or, how to get him to crush on you or something. It's never about the girl herself. And so, and that again plays out in the research that shows that, in sexual situations, girls don't know how to set boundaries. They don't know how to say when they don't feel comfortable, when they want to stop, or even how to sort of find their own areas of pleasure and satisfaction. So girls are being deprived, I think, of good sexual experience.
you know, if you could take a copy of this book, The Lolita Effect, and force Barack Obama and John McCain each to read it separately, I assume, we'll give them their own copies. And then you were given an audience with each of them for 20 minutes, and they said, I read your book. I think you really make some great points, Professor Durham. What can I do to help as president? What would you tell them?
Oh, wow, what a great question. Well, what I would like to do is for public officials, leaders like them, to bring this into the public sphere, to maybe set up think tanks, to organize public discussions, to support consortia, and I think my own personal position on this is that we need better sex education in the schools. We need to have, you know, not just sex education, but media literacy education. I mean, that's something that I think is absolutely crucial, that we need mandatory media literacy education in the K-12 curriculum, that it's in this media-saturated environment, it's as important as reading and math for kids to be able to, you know, understand the messages that are coming to them, the motivations behind the messages, and how to make good decisions about these things. Kids have to learn how to take control of their media environment. So I think I have a whole list of suggestions for both, for either Obama or McCain, you know, whoever comes through victorious in November. And, you know, it would help us to move forward with this and to solve some of the problems that these images are generating.
I mean, one of the elements of this, the concerns you raise in this book, The Lolita Effect, The Sexualization of Young Girls, is that as far as I can tell, it cuts across the political spectrum indiscriminately. I mean, it's not just a left issue or a right issue. Am I wrong, or do you think that's correct?
Well, I don't think it should be a partisan issue, and I think that's one real big problem that we're confronting as well. Because, you know, on the right, there seems to be a sort of or at least a perception of a kind of crackdown attitude toward sex, that we can't talk about it, that we have to try to repress it, and that we, you know, that any discussion of sex is bad, which, you know, of course is a problem, because we're all sexual. Sex is natural. It's part of being human. And so, I mean, it has to be part of what we think about when we think about how to live in a society or in a culture. And then the opposite of that is what we tend to characterize as the liberal view, which is anything goes. You know, it's all good, it's all okay, and that if you say anything critical, then immediately you're moving over to the dark side where, you know, you're repressing sex. And I think that's a ridiculous position as well, that we need to find a middle ground, that we've got to move away from these polarities that are so oversimplified and so counterproductive, and find a position where we can talk about all the complexities of this this issue in ways that are actually good for society and good for kids.
Now, we only have a minute or so left, minute and a half left, and this, if you can't answer this question, you'll be a long line of people who can't. But I know that in some European countries, they prohibit television advertising to children under 12. Mm-hmm. And those same countries always have public broadcasting systems that offer lots of non-commercial shows to kids under 12, boys and girls. Do you have any idea if that has any effect in sort of undermining or neutralizing or slowing down the Lolita effect in those countries?
As far as I can see, it's had very positive effect, because those countries include Sweden, for example, mm-hmm. where they have very low rates of teen pregnancy and abortion and STDs. So you know, whatever they're doing, I don't know if there's a direct causal connection, but it certainly seems to be part of an overall environment that is helping kids to make better decisions about their sex lives. And again, it may be just one part of a number of factors that they're doing in those societies to deal with this problem more effectively than we are. I'm always very cautious about censorship. I mean, but again, some degree of regulation may in fact be helpful. I'm not exactly sure where I come down on that, because the other part of me thinks you can't keep kids in a bubble forever. You know, at some point they have to learn how to deal with this media environment. They have to learn how to cope with it and, you know, resist it where they need to and kind of make good decisions for themselves about it. So I also think we could begin educating our kids much earlier, and maybe this is another thing for Obama and McCain that we need.
Well, you
more.
Know, on that note, I'm afraid, Gigi Durham, I've got to let you go. I heard the band tuning up in the background. Gigi Durham, author of The Lolita Effect, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
It's been great having you. I'm Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer, and Dave Heckman, who's been working the board. See you in 167 hours.